KALW. From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Oakland.
I'm from Cleveland Heights.
West Oakland, California.
Rome 58.
I actually don't live in Oakland, I live in Richmond.
Coming up, we'll get to the bottom of a mystery found in San Francisco intersections.
And I, like many other people, have wondered, what the hell's underneath those brick circles?
Then we'll hear how one musician is working to make music education accessible to everybody.
I've lived a whole, complete, full life in music, and I'm going to die with my life in music.
And we'll hear how one group has orchestrated a classical flash mob.
We like places that are accessible where people walking by can stop and say, what's this, a whole orchestra? What's going on?
Music where you least expect it. Cross Currents is next. Stay tuned. People have been trying to protect their cities from natural disasters for about as long as those cities have existed. Take San Francisco. The 1906 earthquake and fire was the most devastating disaster in the city's history. Afterwards, the fire department developed a unique system to try to prevent that kind of destruction from ever happening again. And though you might not realize it, you can see evidence of that system in today's city streets. KALW's Audrey Dilling shows us where to look.
Oh, wow, there it is. There it is. We have a winner.
Hava Cronenberg is on a manhole hunt.
I'm pretty surprised we found that. I thought it was looking pretty bad.
Cronenberg is a volunteer helping a local artist with a project. She's biking around the city with her partner for the day, Lucas Keining, who's visiting from Holland. They've got a list of the potential locations of a specific kind of manhole. Their assignment is to find as many of these manholes as they can, take a picture, and grab the GPS coordinates using a smartphone app.
What do they call a manhole in Holland?
A put deksel, or a riool deksel, I think.
What does that translate to?
Sewer lid, I guess, yeah. But we don't talk about them that much, I guess. It's not like the
common,
the most interesting thing
in
Holland.
It's not like they're the subject of radio stories.
No, maybe not.
But these sewer lids are totally radio worthy. You might have even seen them around San Francisco. They look just like any other manhole, but these ones are each surrounded by a ring of bricks about 20 feet across.
A lot of people have noticed the brick circles around San Francisco.
That's San Francisco artist Scott Kildall. He's the one who sent Cronenberg and Keining out on their mission. Kildall is working on a project to make people more aware of city infrastructure. As far as he knows, no one has ever created a complete map of all these brick rings. So that's part of his project.
And then once you point them out to him, you can't not see them in San Francisco. Everywhere you look seems to be these brick circles. And I, like many other people, have wondered, what the hell is underneath those brick circles?
So what the hell is under there? I'll let this guy answer that.
Could you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Assistant Deputy Chief Ken Lombardi with the San Francisco Fire Department.
And what are we looking at right now? What's that brick ring?
Right now you're looking at a cistern, and it's a concrete vault underneath the ground.
Beneath the lid is a dark pool of water.
This is our emergency water supply. As long as we pull that manhole cover, there'll be 75,000 gallons of water there for us.
The cisterns are totally unconnected from the rest of the water system. There are no pipes running in or out. Almost 200 of them are scattered around San Francisco. And Lombardi says this is the only city that has them. To understand why, we need to go back to the gold rush. Can I get some period music? Excellent.
Well, in those days, San Francisco had several problems.
That's Robert Graysmith. He wrote a book called Black Fire, which is about six major fires that ravaged San Francisco between 1849 and 1851. And he's right. Back then, the city had problems. For starters, it was basically a tinderbox. The buildings were all made of wood, old boat parts, canvas, whatever was lying around. There was also no plumbing and no official fire department. Instead, troops of volunteer firefighters formed.
If you were a fireman, you were the elite, because these volunteers were, they dressed, they were handsome, sexy. They had tight leggings and shiny boots and red jackets, but they risked their lives and they paid for their own uniforms, the upkeep of the engines, they paid for the engines. They did everything themselves.
They were also kind of the broiest bros in Brotown. They would race to be the first to the fire and sometimes get in fistfights along the way, which sounds even crazier when you understand just how hard it was to get anywhere at the time. What were some of the things they were up against? I primarily want to talk about the mud. I want to make sure we talk about the mud.
That's funny. Yeah, my editor, everybody loves that part. The street, you literally, to try to cross the street back in 1850, you were taking your life in your hands. There have been scenes where a guy's driving his wagon with all the horses, and the whole thing gets sucked right down. He's still cracking the whip. And literally, they would have to lasso people and pull them onto the planks built along the road.
Let's just say urban planning wasn't the city's strong suit. And remember, there's no plumbing. So the volunteers had to haul 2,000-pound water tanks through these muddy streets and then fight a raging fire.
Pumping the water was so difficult, you could break an arm, and people did.
And then, after all that work, sometimes the water tank would run dry before the fire went out. So some of the fire chiefs got together and begged the city for help. They asked for underground water storage tanks to be built around San Francisco, and the city built about a dozen, the first San Francisco cisterns. The fire epidemic stopped after 1851, and by the late 1860s, San Francisco had both an official fire department and underground plumbing. The city kept some of the cisterns full, but basically, they were old news.
They were a laughingstock of the city.
That's San Francisco artist Scott Kildall again.
People were wondering, why are we spending any money filling up these banks of water that we're never going to use? Mm-hmm. And then lo and behold, when the 1906 earthquake struck,
fires broke out and the water mains burst.
And so the fire department couldn't put out the actual fires all over the city. And it was at that point that they tapped into these old cisterns that they had been diligently filling up every year and put out some of the fires in Telegraph Hill and Rincon Hill and helped save vital portions of the city.
Despite these few victories, the 1906 fire raged for 3 days, destroying huge portions of the city. Later, a national fire board declared that if enough water had been available, it most likely could have been put out in the first day. So in 1908, the city passed a $5 million bond to fund a backup water supply system, including separate pipes for fighting fires and about 150 new cisterns. These are all still up and running today, but
the reality is that most people don't actually notice the cisterns until you point them out to them.
And that's what Kildall's trying to do with his mapping project, point them out.
What I hope people take away from the Waterworks project is that there's an amazing circulatory system that lives underneath our feet. And it's something that I think we don't think about very often, that we take for granted that water just flows when we turn on the tap.
He's got us going a lot of places.
With help from volunteers like Lucas Kining and Hava Cronenberg, Kildall has made an illustrated map of about 120 San Francisco cisterns. It's his way of reminding us to pay attention to the stories underneath our feet.
That's part of being a cistern detective.
Yeah, come on, brothers and cisterns, yeah.
For Cross Currents, I'm Audrey Dillon.
To find that map of San Francisco's cisterns, go to klw.org and click Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Trombonist and music educator Angela Wellman grew up in one of the cradles of American music, Kansas City, Missouri. Raised in a musical family, surrounded by Kansas City's rich jazz and blues legacy, it's no surprise she's grown up to be a powerful musician and transmitter of that legacy herself. Now based in the East Bay, Wellman founded the Oakland Public Conservatory of Music in 2005 to provide high-quality, affordable music education to Oaklanders of all ages. In creating the school, Wellman was addressing a need she'd been aware of since she herself was a young person in conservatory. She spoke with KALW's Jen Sheehan about that history and how she's making a difference today.
I want to know what it was like growing up surrounded by music and surrounded by musicians.
Jazz is one of the musics that is probably foundational to my musical heritage and development. And coming from Kansas City, Missouri, which is one of the cornerstones of jazz music, the development of the music called jazz in the United States. My parents, my mother played classical piano, and she was a jazz vocalist. My father was a jazz pianist and a career serviceman in the Air Force. Wherever he was stationed, and mostly those were places, you know, like in Guam and Okinawa and France and, you know, places like that, he always had a jazz trio with a couple of other airmen, so they always played. So that moves us into my other part of my heritage, which is my uncle, whose name is Eddie Baker Sr. He is the founder of a place called the Charlie Parker Academy of Visual and Performing Arts, which is my inspiration for the Public Conservatory. And so my uncle was friends with Count Basie. And so I grew up in that environment. Whenever Count Basie was even anywhere near Kansas City, he would call up my uncle, because my uncle cut his hair. If he was in St. Louis, you know, he'd fly over to Kansas City
real
quick.
That is an intimate relationship.
Yeah, they were, I would say, the way Uncle Ed described it, it's like he was like a surrogate son of Count Basie. They, you know, that music, the music thing, right? I started playing trombone in the sixth grade. And
I'm curious how you picked trombone, or did trombone pick you?
That's an interesting question, and I love this story, because back to my uncle, he had a big band. My mother sang with that big band. So I would go to the rehearsals. My place was to sit behind the trombones. And there was a guy there named Godfrey. He played trombone. And I had a crush on him. You know, I just loved the way he looked. You know, just look at him and watch him play trombone. And I don't know, when the time came to choose an instrument to play in the sixth grade, I chose a trombone just like that. I loved the trombone. I loved the sound of it, the tone of it, the timbre of it. I wanted to play classical trombone. So going to the Conservatory of Music in Kansas City, where I did my undergraduate studies, that's what I wanted to do. But I was pigeonholed and pushed sort of toward that direction.
And you I had mean towards jazz,
yeah.
You're saying?
Yeah, I mean, you know,
even
when
though
you
that's
go
not
to
what
mu-
you wanted to do.
Yeah, when you go to music school, you know, you play in all the bands and things. I didn't grow up playing trombone and classical and studying and playing in orchestras. So when I got to college, what
that was
I
your
knew,
chance.
Yeah, and it was my chance. And but what I knew was jazz, so I played in the jazz band and that sort of thing. But as I started to study more, the repertoire and you know the etudes, and I got back in touch with that part of me that wanted to play that music more.
I'm curious how your personal experiences in music conservatory shaped what you wanted to do with the Oakland Public Conservatory and what led you to found that.
Well, I started studying at the Kansas City Conservatory of Music when I was about 5 or 6 years old. You know, piano lessons, right? All the musicians in Kansas City, black musicians that I knew, because I didn't know any white musicians, but the black musicians I knew, they all studied at the conservatory as well, and some of them taught there. There were very few little black kids, though kids who looked like me, going in those halls at the conservatory studying, you know. And I remember just hearing the music coming out of those rooms.
which is probably also why I began to really love classical music, because I would go once a week for my lessons, you know, and I'd hear something other than the jazz music. So I got a real rich experience of hearing at least two different, you know, types and styles and cultural expressions of music, right? Then, you know, when I started teaching here in the Bay Area, in Oakland, in West Oakland, I recognized that there were so many gifted little children of color, particularly black children, and I saw myself in them. But what I didn't see were the opportunities that I had growing up to study music comprehensively and deeply. And so I recognized, okay, so where did I get what I have, okay? I went there as a kid at a conservatory. I graduated my undergraduate from a conservatory. And at the time I created the Oakland Public Conservatory, I had also received a master's degree in music education from another popular, famous, you know, conservatory, the Eastman School of Music in Rochester, New York. And in all of those places, there were very few African Americans, you know, and I thought that there was something wrong with that. The music of the United States is grounded in the African American experience. Soul, jazz, R&B, blues, everything. I felt like it was very important to have a place where people could go, black people particular, and other youth of color for sure, could go and study music deeply in a rigorous environment like the conservatories provide, and have access to affordable music education, not just for kids but for the whole community, because inside of music is where our culture and the history and the knowledge of our culture resides.
That was trombonist and music educator Angela Wellman speaking with KALW's Jen Chien. For more information about Angela Wellman and the Oakland Public Conservatory, go to KALW.org and click Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Now, we're going to drop in on some other East Bay musicians gathering to play classical music. But instead of a traditional concert hall, they meet in warehouses or museums. No one's wearing a tie or gown, and the group has not rehearsed. They play a few pieces together and swill free beer between sets. This is Awesome Orchestra. It's the brainchild of David Meschler, a freelance musical director for theater and opera companies. He wanted to find a way to make classical music fun and accessible, so we started bringing musicians together for impromptu concerts, open to the public, and admission is free. Players are volunteers, and no audition is required. KALW's Mary Reese dusted off her clarinet and dropped in to play along. She brings us this story.
I'm standing in what looks like an oversized carport with rain pounding on the corrugated roof. A handful of people are moving furniture and setting up microphones and a mixing board. They're converting this airy art space into a concert hall.
When the band gets here, they're going to go around to the back.
Okay.
And they're going to load in that way because it's much drier and much safer.
That's David Meschler, conductor and founding artistic director of the Awesome Orchestra. His crew is unloading instruments, a timpani, bass drums, cymbals, snare drums, out of the back of a van. We're a block from Ashby Bart. The front doors and windows of this makeshift concert hall open directly onto the sidewalk.
We like places that are accessible where people walking by can stop and say, what's this, a whole orchestra? What's going on?
By noon, about 90 musicians sit in close half circles around Meschler, who's at the conductor's stand. The violins and violas sit closest, with the cellos and basses to the side. The woodwinds come next. The brass, trumpets, trombones, and tubas are up on the stage behind us. It's crowded. People pull out their instruments and start tuning strings, sucking on reeds, and playing scales. I open my case and put my clarinet together. I'm a little nervous. It's been a long time since I've played with a group.
Let's take a tuning note from one of the oboes back there for the winds and brass. Hopefully. The rain is in A, hopefully.
Meschler raises his baton and guides the warm-ups. He says his conducting style is less traditional than some conductors. Sometimes he'll even just start the group off and let them finish on their own.
Because I'm not their boss. I'm just kind of like an air traffic controller, like, over here, a little slower. Okay, stop, you know? So as opposed to somebody who's in charge of them.
We're working from sheet music, but we haven't rehearsed together. The piece we're about to play is the score for one of the Lord of the Rings movies.
In a fast three at first. Ready? And what?
Around 50 people, mostly in their 20s and 30s, pack the edges of the room. They're here just to listen.
Pretty good sight reading for an orchestra, right?
Performing movie scores and other contemporary classical music, as well as pieces by composers like Prokofiev and Mahler, is part of the Awesome Orchestra's mission. Meschler says the group seeks out musical adventures of all kinds.
Orchestras are a really amazing, powerful thing. And unfortunately, for many different reasons, over the last several hundred years, they've become fundamentally more and more inaccessible. And we need to give this to everyone. We need to give this opportunity to listen to stuff, or to play it, or just to be involved somehow up close.
Another way Meschler keeps the material fresh is by trying out new work by contemporary composers.
Next up, very, very exciting. We're going to do premiere reading of a new piece by a local composer named Jacob Bertrand called The Cloud Gatherer.
The Cloud Gatherer is based on a poem. Looking at the clarinet part, I think it looks pretty simple, but coming in at the right time with the right volume is key. I'm pretty excited to be part of the first ever ensemble to play this piece. We've been playing for 90 minutes, and my embouchure, my mouth and jaw, are really tired. It's time for a break. People get up to grab a beer, say hi to friends, and use the bathroom. Right now, since talking is easier for me than playing one more note, I set out to meet my fellow musicians. Lucy Giraldo plays violin and viola in a string quartet and in an indie folk band.
They're all very different. Yeah, I like putting my finger in different types of pies, musical pies. It's just such a fun, casual environment to come and play classical music with people. It's not high pressure. It's not stuffy. We're not in suits and ties.
Sitting a few rows away is Sally Johnson. She plays French horn in several different East Bay orchestras. But for her, the Awesome Orchestra stands out.
Well, number one, it's really good musicians. It's demanding to be able to come in here and sight read the music and learn it to the degree that it's passable to play it, to perform it.
For me, participation in the Awesome Orchestra really was awesome. It was exciting and stirring to play among 90 other musicians. It felt powerful to bring these symphonic pieces to breathing, pulsating life. And I did have fun, despite my aching jaw and ragged lower lip. In Berkeley, this is Mary Reese for Cross Currents.
Dirk Epperson of the Academy of Art University contributed his students' recordings to this story. Thank you, Dirk. The next Awesome Orchestra session takes place on April 7th in downtown Oakland. All that information is at kalw.org and click on Cross Currents. And that's all for Cross Currents today. Our team includes Lila Day, Nina Gensler-Debs, Olivia Henry, Angela Johnston, Jeremy Jew, Ted Muldoon, Lisa Morehouse, Chris Hoff, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, Carrie Spivak, and Andrew Stelzer. Today's show was engineered by James Rollins. The line producer was Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by an Oakland band called Porch. You can hear them on Saturday. They play the Nightlight on Broadway in Oakland, and it's their last show before they start a European tour. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.